Hello, everybody. Welcome again to the Monday Night Live Chat Show. Welcome if you're watching this on YouTube or listening to this on the Negotiators podcast. My name's Derek Arden, and I'm absolutely delighted today to invite an old friend of mine, somebody I've known for a number of years, John Vine, to join us. Let me tell you a little bit about John Vine, CBE, QPM. I know what QPM means, Queen's Police Award. No, it must be a medal. Queen's Award medal. I don't know if John's got that with him at the moment, and he can tell us what CBE is, because he's going to tell us the story of what happened and how he got his CBE, which is very, very interesting. John will tell us how he and I met on a BA flight back from Sofia in Bulgaria. He may also tell us how, by using one of my WOW cards, he got an upgrade in Inverness. And he's going to let us into a few secrets that are in the public domain, but not things which aren't in the public domain. John and I did a course in Inverness, and Carla was on that course. And I think Carol, who's joined us, was on the second course and didn't have the pleasure of meeting John. The key thing that I'm always excited about is when John talks about the G8 conference, where he was the commander of security on behalf of Tony Blair and the Home Secretary to make sure that everybody stayed safe. President Putin, President Bush, Mrs. Merkel, Tony Blair, etc. But also at the same time to make it look a casual conference, that there wasn't much security there. John, I don't know how you did that. That sounds like the biggest hospital pass ever that you could have had. And a little few interesting for football fans, John was the commander at Elland Road, the Leeds United home ground, which is notoriously for a bit of aggravation before he did that. So John's done a lot of roles, including being the chief inspector of borders, which I have a feeling we might leave for next year. John, welcome. Thanks for joining us. It's a great pleasure to have you here. Tell us about how we met and one or two stories, please.
Okay, right. Well, thanks, Derek. And as I said, you know, it's difficult to get a word in edgeways sometimes, so I'm glad you've stopped talking. So several years ago, I did I was the Inspector of Borders and Immigration. I was invited to speak on that subject at a conference in Sofia in Bulgaria. And we ended up on the same flight back from Sofia. And I got the middle seat. And so I was a bit trapped. So there was a guy on my left. I was in the middle seat. And then this guy on my right happened to be somebody called Derek Arden, who started engaging me in conversation. Now, it had been a pretty arduous conference because the chairman of the conference hadn't turned up. He was ill, unexpectedly ill. So I had actually part-chaired the conference as well. And all I really wanted to do was go to sleep. But I realized with Derek next to me, that was impossible. So I just had to make a judgment call whether I should try and ignore this guy next to me or engage with him. So eventually I engaged with him and we've been good friends ever since. And a year or so ago, we did a conference together in Inverness. And when I arrived, the conference was in full swing. And I asked the receptionist, you know, where it was taking place. And she said, well, who is it who's running? I said, Derek Arden. She said, oh, he's a wonderful man. What a wonderful guy. And I said, well, what makes you say that? He said, well, he gave me this card. And he'd given her a WOW card, which told her how wonderful she was. And it worked a treat. And she said, look, any friend of Derek's is a friend of mine. Would you like an upgrade to an executive room? I said, yeah, that'd be great. So, you know, Derek had worked his wonders yet again. So what I'd like to do is to talk to you a little bit about some of the tactics and strategies that I've used over the years in order to, I suppose, negotiate and influence. And I'm going to use the G8 summit in 2005 as an example of that, as a case study, really. So I had a lot of experience in previous roles at chief officer level before I went to Scotland as a chief constable in 2000. I'd led the security of the Conservative Party conference for two years at Blackpool, when they met at Blackpool. I'd done football ground commander work, and I'd been a public order commander as well. So I'd had a lot of experience of that sort of thing. And in 2003, Tony Blair decided to have his world leaders conference at Gleneagles, which was on my patch in Tayside in Scotland. So Tayside no longer exists as a force. It's now part of Police Scotland, comprises of Dundee, Perthyn Ross and Angus. And slap bang in the middle of Perthyn Ross is the Glen Eagles Hotel. Glen Eagles Hotel was one of the first privatisations in the Thatcher era. It used to be a railway hotel. And one of the first privatisations that Thatcher made was of the railway hotels. And so it's now a very swish venue. And what Tony Blair wanted was something akin to a country house hotel. Because when world leaders come together for the G8,
John, I think you've muted. I think, or I've muted you, or somebody's muted.
You muted me. I didn't touch anything. So what they want to do is they want to get together in an informal atmosphere, ties off, and they want to talk about world events. So what's important is when you're delivering one of these is to secure the centre, to make sure that they can wander around at will, that they can chat, get together in little sort of corners of the room and of the venue, and over a 2 or 3 day period and have that sort of arrangement. And that's what Tony Blair saw that Glen Eagles would offer. And indeed, it is a very nice hotel, stuck in the middle of hundreds of acres of Perthshire with very little, you know, nearby. The history of G8 summits is that they used to attract a great deal of anti-capitalist protest. In fact, they still do. And the Glen Eagles event was the 31st such event. In January in 2001, there was mass rioting and disorder, and a protester was shot dead by the security services. And so in order to avoid that, that actually became a watershed, because in order to avoid that sort of thing happening, the following year when the G8 went to Canada, the idea was to actually stick it in a resort called Kananaskis, which is apparently in the middle of the Rocky Mountains. So the idea was to try and not have the G8 somewhere near a populated area, but to stick it somewhere remote. So in London, and you know, there was at least one Scot in the audience who'll probably smile at this. In London, somebody decided that Glen Eagles was remote. You know, Scotland was remote. But actually, if you look where Glen Eagles is, it's far from remote, because there's a main road called the A9 runs right the way past it and right the way up, you know, to the north, the northeast of Scotland. And so the challenge of securing this venue was considerable. And this is a championship golf event, a golf course, and you can drive into the lay-by on the A9, and then you can step over a small wicket fence, you know, into the golf course from the road. And so it was a big challenge to, it took 2 years of planning to actually prepare this venue for, as a suitable venue to have a high security event. One of the biggest challenges was trying to secure it. And you can only really secure something like that by putting a barrier to enclose it. And that was one of the biggest initial problems, because what the world leaders didn't want was to be seen to be having a world leader summit in what looked like a high security prison. And so there was a lot of negotiation around the way we would actually secure the venue. You clearly couldn't just leave it open, and you couldn't partition off part of the golf course. We had to do the whole of the golf course. And so we put something akin to we put a fence all the way around it, but it wasn't the sort of thing that you perhaps see at a pop concert or somewhere like, for example, Glastonbury, where you'd have like a 20-foot solid barrier. So we had to discuss very carefully with the key players about, you know, how the thing looked. And at the end of the day, that was quite difficult for me, because, of course, I'd be held accountable for if the security was breached. We also set out right from the beginning, and I think this is really important in any big event, you set out a strategy and parameters within which you're going to operate. And this is really important, because you need those to come back to when things go wrong. And it's important you're not seen to, I think, to be making it up as you go along. So setting key strategic objectives right at the beginning was absolutely critical. And they were three, basically, to provide a safe and secure world summit. You know, clearly it would have been severely career limiting for me if the security had been breached. And, you know, the whole event, you know, would have had to have been stopped, you know, in order to get people out of the secure zone. The second objective was actually to minimize disruption to the local community, because they haven't asked for this to be on their patch. And all they needed to do, of course, was to go onto the internet and discover the rioting and disorder and damage that had occurred in many other of these events. So they were really concerned about it. And last but not least, the third objective was to enable lawful protest, because enabling lawful protest is part of what we do in a liberal democracy. And those were three key objectives that we wanted to lay out right at the start. And in addition, there were some key early decisions that set us in on the right track, right from the word go. One of the things I knew that I had to do, because my force had about 1,200 police officers and 600 or 700 members of support staff, I knew I'd have to bring lots of extra police officers to help us deliver this. In fact, I brought in 12,500 extra police officers from right the way across the UK on a mutual aid arrangement. So some of the figures are incredible. 12,500 extra officers, 56,000 hot meals a day, 2,500 vehicles to help us do this. You know, some of the logistics were incredible. But with those police officers came the need to provide them with accommodation, as well as meals and food. And so right at the start of the 2-year planning period, I booked lots and lots of accommodation. And there were two reasons for that. First of all, we knew that, you know, cops would need to sleep somewhere. But also, I knew that the anti-capitalist protesters would have to stay somewhere as well. And they'd want to stay somewhere near the venue. And so I booked everything up about 2 years out. And that was then quite an inspired decision, actually, even though I say so myself, because, you know, when a lot of people wanted to find accommodation in order to protest at the event, they couldn't find it because it was all in our hands. So I think right at the beginning, I had about 11,000 bedrooms booked in my name. You know, halls of residence at universities, hotels in the area and beyond. So some of those key decisions helped shape subsequent events. Should I just stop there for a minute, Derek? Because you wanted this to be a conversation rather than me blether on for...
Well, you accused me of talking too much, John, so I didn't really want you to do that again, but otherwise I'll have to buy you another meal. I think there's some takeaways there. Those figures are absolutely extraordinary. I've heard you tell this story three times and I'd forgotten 12,500 officers drafted into a police force of just over 1,000. How did TripAdvisor, John, feel about you booking every hotel north of Glasgow and Edinburgh and south of Thurso?
I don't think there was a TripAdvisor. I don't think there was a TripAdvisor then. In fact, I don't think the internet really had got going. I remember when we went to Scotland, we still had dial-up. That was the end of 2000. So although we make these assumptions about the internet now, we're used to obviously using the internet for everything. But I think what helped enormously was that, of course, we didn't have a fully fledged internet. Mm. So one of the things that that happened at the start of the event, because when you're planning for this type of thing, you always have to plan for the unexpected. And there were two stories that I'd like to tell which sort of illustrated this. As we got nearer and nearer the time, lots of people who are very important people come out of the woodwork and decide that they need to be briefed about what the plans are to secure something like this. And one of those people is usually the Home Secretary. And even though I was a chief constable in Scotland, and I actually reported to Scottish ministers, in fact, Jack McConnell was the first minister of Scotland at the time, and we had a good relationship with his administration. When it came near at the time, the Home Secretary has residual responsibility for national security issues across the UK, wanted a briefing. And I went down to London at his invitation and to his office in the Home Office with my staff officer, who decided to download the presentation onto one of these newfangled USB sticks. So up until that period, most people had these discs, didn't they? We used discs. Anyway, USB sticks came out. And so we're in there with the Home Secretary, and he's a busy man, and he wants the presentation. So we did the pleasantries, and we discover that his private secretary and my staff officer are struggling with the equipment that's against the wall. And what had happened is that some bright spark had actually fastened the computer down with a metal strap onto a stand, fixed it to the wall, but so near the wall that we couldn't get the USB stick in the slot. So the USB slot was at the back of the computer, and we couldn't actually physically get it in. So we had to do the briefing on the laptop. So that was the first thing that we, you know, didn't cater for. And the second story is when we started the G8 summit, and the operation was around the 5th of July 2005. It was a really interesting two or three days. I'll go into more detail in a minute. Tony Blair wasn't there because Tony Blair was in Singapore trying to fight for the Olympics to come to London. And if you remember, the Olympics, the favourite country to have the Olympics in 2012 was going to be Paris. And his mission was to go to Singapore, where the judging was taking place, and persuade the powers that be to have it in London instead. And he succeeded in doing that. That dominated the headlines on the 6th of July. But the person who did arrive was George Bush. And George Bush is a born-again Christian, keep fit fanatic. And he does a lot of cycling. So off Air Force One came his bicycle with his security detail also on bicycles. And in order to kill the boredom while other world leaders were coming back from Singapore to join him, he decided to do speed cycling around the central security area around Gleneagles Hotel. And there'd been a shower of rain. So coming round a bend at speed, he lost control of the bike, went over the handlebars, hit the road with parts of his body, but also in the process, he hit one of our officers who was stood on a point. And the officer had to be carted off to the Perth Royal Infirmary with a suspected broken ankle. George Bush ended up in the infirmary because apart from anything else, we'd also set up an infirmary, a hospital, a mini hospital on site, you know, for anybody who was there as a delegate who needed medical treatment. So we had some really good doctors, surgeons, dentists, you know, sat around reading copies of Hello magazine, ready to spring into action, you know, to actually deal with anything untoward. And who should be wheeled in to see them but the President of the United States? So I was in the control room at the time, and one of my officers said, "You'll never guess what's happened." I said, "What?" He said, "Well, George Bush has just fallen off his bike and injured one of our officers and put him in hospital. What do we do?" I said, "Well, first of all, let's make sure that the CCTV coverage is secure and in our hands before you know, it has a wider circulation. And secondly, we should inquire about, you know, the health of both of them, really." And at the end of the day, I think the president actually rang the hospital and asked after the welfare of the officer, which was, you know, I have this surreal picture of the trolley phone being wheeled to the bedside at the hospital, and the officer picking up the receiver and being told that the person at the other end is the President of the United States of America. That actually is on the, that's on the web, actually. It's still on a BBC News item on the internet. But many people don't realise that that happened. And it was one of those things that, you know, we'd never actually planned for, clearly. So things can happen which you never planned for.
Yeah, that's brilliant, John. Where was Tony Blair? He was still on the plane coming back from Singapore, or did you have to...
Yeah, Tony Blair and the French president came back almost simultaneously from Singapore. And then on the evening of the first day, we had the Queen and Prince Philip arrive for a royal reception, you know, a dinner with the head of state. And at that point, the whole operation was in full swing. So it was a very exciting time, really. One of the things that, you know, we did is we, in the planning of this whole thing, and it's something I believe, and I brought into my role when I was the Chief Inspector of Borders, it's always useful to challenge what you're doing. And in the planning of this operation, I brought experts from other parts of the UK and from other police forces, in particular the Metropolitan Police, which of course has a much is much bigger and has much more experience in dealing with protesters on a sort of a weekly and monthly basis. And we brought experts together to a challenge event where we had on a monthly basis people who'd planned parts of the security operation at Gleneagles. And we had them at one side of the table presenting their plans. On the other side of the table, chaired by me, I was surrounded by other experts from other forces and other institutions. And we try and find fault with the plans, you know, in a constructive way. What we try and do is challenge the planning and ask if they'd thought of this, whether this had been considered. And we put scenarios to them, which was resisted at first. I mean, this wasn't a popular suggestion of mine amongst my own officers and staff, but it worked a treat. I mean, it was well received at the end of the day because everybody involved could see that the whole benefit was to, you know, make the mistakes when it didn't really matter and avoid making mistakes when it does actually matter. And so that sort of meticulous planning and challenging of the plans as they exist, I think is really important in any big operation like this in order to try and reassure yourself that it's going to be okay. Because 2 years out seems like a long time, but the time passes very quickly and you suddenly find yourself as the officer in overall command of something like this, you find yourself running out of time. And there's nothing you can do about that. So you want to get to the point where, you know, you're days out from the thing happening for real. And you want to feel reassured that you've done everything you possibly could have done, you know, to assure yourself it's going to go well.
I think that's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant thing, John. I'll just stop you there for a minute because I think that we can all learn from that big time on anything we do. And I was just going to mention stress again at that point. So presumably that reassured you that you could sleep at night. And if something did go wrong, you could justify it, presumably, to the Prime Minister or to the Home Secretary, which isn't something I'd want to be worrying about.
Yeah, you've got two or three things, I think, to think about. First of all, I mean, your own officers, you know, are looking to you for leadership and they're looking to you to exude confidence that what we're doing actually will work. And it's really important to, you know, I did a lot of media around this for 2 years on the run-up to the event and a lot of media at the event itself, because not only do your own officers who are drawn from your community want that from a professional point of view, the community wants to hear, you know, the leader of the operation show some confidence that it's going to be fine and they're going to be safe. So I did a lot of, in fact, one of the things that Will Kintish mentioned last week resonated with me when Will was talking about working a room, actually. And I did a lot of community events in and around Octorada. And it was really important for me to work the room and reassure people that I was a human being, B, that I knew what I was talking about, and C, that, you know, I had a plan that would likely work, because they were really concerned that their homes and livelihoods would be trashed by protesters trying to get to the event. And, you know, they had very good reason for thinking that, because all they needed to do was to go and look at the pictures of other events where, you know, millions of pounds worth or euros or dollars worth of damage had been done when the forces of law enforcement had lost control.
The other thing you mentioned to me, John, was...
Let me finish this point. Yeah. When you go to those meetings, it's something I've always done, and Will picked it up in his presentation last week. I always arrive early, and instead of standing off and sitting around on the desk at the top of the room, I always go and say hello to people and introduce myself, because it helps disarm them and put them at their ease. Because otherwise, if you just stand aloof, you become a target, and it's important not to become a target. It's important for them to relate to you, and it makes the whole event much more constructive in my experience. So people, it takes the sting out of what potentially could be quite a confrontational meeting.
Absolutely, John. I was just going to add that that's something I learned from Patricia Fripp, because when she came to the UK to be the keynote speaker at the speaking conference, Patricia always starts early, 20 minutes early, builds rapport with the audience, and the audience aren't even quite sure who she is at that point, but it makes a massive difference. And from that day onwards, I've also done exactly the same, because you connect with quite a few individuals. Fantastic. And most people don't do that. I think that's the point I wanted to make.
I think the other thing as well is look for symbols as well. So one of the things I did was, we had... Oxarada is a small village. In fact, it's a long village. It's called the Lang Toon, which Duncan will be able to translate for you as the Long Town. Okay, so it's like a ribbon development on a road, and it's quite an affluent town, and it's got a strong sense of community. What they didn't have really was a dedicated community officer. So I nominated an officer. You know, he agreed to do it, of course, and just tell him to do it. We found an officer who was an older officer who wanted a good operational background. We gave him a bike, right? We bought a bike and we said, right, you are the Oxarada G8 community officer. You want to do nothing else but to police this community, to cycle up and down, speak to people, engage with them about what we're doing, and provide that ongoing reassurance. And that's your job, really, for, you know, like a year out for the whole event. And it was one of the best things we did. Quite a simple thing. It was one of the best things we did. And what we also used it, the government used it as well, to provide reassurance. We had him nearer the time when the whole theme of the conference included an attempt to try and make poverty history in Africa. I don't know if you remember Bob Geldof and Bono, yeah. You know, were campaigning to make poverty history. And as well as the G8 leaders, Tony Blair invited all the BRIC economy leaders, you know, Brazil, India, et cetera, and all the African leaders to Gleneagles as well. So not only did we have the eight world leaders, we had all the others as well, in order to pursue this theme of make poverty history. And so the community raised a petition to support make poverty history. They gave it to the officer. So we had the cameras there from various TV programs. They gave the time of the conference, they gave the petition to the officer. The officer was filmed cycling out of Oxarada. Then we stuck him on a train down to London and we had him cycle into Downing Street. Okay. And so he cycled into Downing Street, knocked on the door of Downing Street and gave the petition from Oxarada to the Prime Minister on the doorstep of number 10 Downing Street. And it was actually a really nice thing to do for the community. It brought them into the security around the event. And it was a good thing, I think, for the police force to do, to try and show that we were still connected with reality, with the needs of the community, and we weren't sort of like an invasion force of 12,000 odd people who, you know, were going to, that they needed to fear just as much as the opposition.
What a brilliant idea, John. Brilliant, brilliant. A few things. I just wanted to mention that you mentioned to me, what, number one, what about the anarchists? Number two, didn't a bomb go off in London at the same time and blow up a bus in Tavistock Square?
Yeah.
And did Tony Blair say to you, if this goes wrong, John, I'll have your head?
No, that was when I did the briefing for the Home Secretary, actually. It was Charles Clarke, who was a really nice guy, actually. And when we'd actually got over the fact that we couldn't get the USB stick into his computer, and I said to him, well, come on, if we just could look together here, we can look at the whole thing on the laptop, on your desk, which is what we did. He turned round to me and he said, well, you do realise, he said, if this goes wrong, there will be an inquiry. And I said, yeah, I think I'd figured that out. But I don't know whether he thought I was actually listening, because he repeated it another time. So probably he thought, you know, he just needs to repeat it so it's sunk in. But clearly, I mean, I was aware that if it went badly wrong, the, you know, the stakes were very high. Mm. Going back to the point you made, the third principle of what we set out to achieve was to facilitate lawful protest. And I think it's important that you treat that very seriously. I mean, we live in a liberal democracy and it's important that people can protest. And there were lots of people who wanted to peacefully protest, and lots of people went to Edinburgh to do that. And also there was a march arranged on the first day of the event, starting from Oxterada, you know, to the venue. And the vast majority of people who took part in that march were peaceful. I mean, there's always an element who, you know, at the G8 who want to storm the barricade, so to speak, and that was the case at that event. But we had an ongoing dialogue with the organisers of protests, which I think worked well at the end of the day, because people are very committed, you know, to the cause that... an anti-capitalist cause, and so it's important to respect that commitment. So we had a good ongoing dialogue. I mean, we did have protests around the event at the time, lock-ons, and the type of thing you would expect, for example, if protesters are protesting at a maybe new bypass through an area of special scientific interest, that sort of thing. So we were prepared for that sort of thing, but the vast majority of the protesters, you know, responded to our requests to tell them what their plans were. Tell us what their plans were, I should say. On the second day of the event, yes, it very unfortunately, very tragically, the bombs went off in London. It was 7/7. And so if you think about it, you know, we started on the 6th of July with all the preparations in place. Everybody, certainly in the UK delegation, was over the moon at the fact that the Olympics had been, you know, the decision had been made to have the Olympics in London in 2012. By the time we got to the 7th of July, at 8:50 in the morning, the first bombs went off in London. And I think there was other bombs went off at around 10 o'clock. And, you know, we had to get the Prime Minister down to London. I think Jack Straw took over his place at the event, leading negotiations. And of course, much of the, not unnaturally, the press interest went down quite rightly to London, because, of course, people were killed and severely injured. So a very tragic final day of the event. I mean, from my point of view, it was really, I didn't know at the time that those... that terrorist act wasn't connected, you know, with the G8. So I locked down the whole place. So it was basically all the delegates were locked in for the second day, and there was very restricted movement in or out, because from a security point of view, I had no idea that the two events weren't related until, you know, much, much later in the day. Mm-hmm. So it was a very stressful time to be the commander of an event such as that. And again, we couldn't actually predict the events of 7/7 occurring, but we had planned meticulously for 2 years, and we just planned and better planned and planned again and checked our plans. And that's really all you can do. You can only plan for what you think, you know, might occur. But we certainly had the resources there to deal with, you know, virtually anything that anybody could throw at us.
That's brilliant, John. There's a lot of questions in the chat box, so I'd like to come
to them. Yeah, let's go for them. Let's go for the questions.
But I'm going to ask you if you'll come back and talk to us about the other subjects while the recording's still on.
So yes, I'll be happy to do so.
Yeah, that's called closing the sale and negotiating.
My wife warned me that you would do that.
I would do that, John. My guests would be very disappointed if I didn't do that.
Yeah. So
my question is, what about George Bush's security? Now, you see the 747 arrive, you see the helicopter get, you know, at Heathrow, flies up to Glen Eagles, and goodness knows how many people in dark glasses. Did you have to report to them as well? And what about Germany and France? And
no, that's not how it works. Obviously, the American delegation tends to be the one of the largest. And it's important, you know, to accommodate everybody's needs. I think what we found is we'd done a lot of work with with all the governments through the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. The Foreign and Commonwealth Office is the government lead for G8. And we'd worked with the FCO for a good couple of years on this. And so they had all the liaison we needed, really, with all those delegations. And what I found is that George Bush was a very friendly guy, actually. Okay, so he had difficulty staying on the bike, but he was a very, very friendly guy. So a good example, a good story is when he was leaving the event, he was getting on Marine One, which is the American president's helicopter, which had landed in the grounds. There'd been a motorcycle outriders and escorts for if any of the world leaders wanted to leave the venue and go somewhere else and come back during the event. And they were stood next, you know, at a safe distance away from the helicopter with their cameras trying to take a picture. And after he'd shaken hands with me and other people who were, you know, the sort of the delegates to the event, the people who'd he was thanking for, you know, for facilitating the whole thing, he saw out of the corner of his eye, he was walking towards the helicopter, and he abandoned walking towards the helicopter and called his wife over, and he went over to the police officers and posed for photographs with them. And he even went back again when he realized that a couple of them hadn't actually got the right shot. And he was very well respected. He was had no edge to him, and an extremely, you know, pleasant character, you know, to meet. So that was our experience of him. And a lot of the cops thought that was a really nice touch.
Okay, John, I'm going to go for the chat box now, and I'll throw some questions out. There's a few that are together. Will Kinchis asked, why so many 12,500 police? And linked to it, at a G8 meeting, how is the catering managed safely and securely? And does the US president have his own chef and his own food? There's three for you to handle.
Right, but let's start in reverse. No, the catering was provided by Glen Eagles. So whether there was somebody in the kitchen at Glen Eagles, Will, just checking on his plate, I'm not sure. The catering was provided by the Metropolitan Police outside catering unit. And so they did a great job. They weren't the cheapest, as I remember, but they did a great job. And I had a hand in... we all had a hand really in evaluating who we should have. And one of the things that happens at a big event, when you have lots of people standing around for 2 or 3 days, you know, officers are only as good on security as the fact, you know, they have to be alert and they have to check passes and all the rest of it. And like all human beings, they get bored. And one of the things that alleviates boredom is the ability to eat and enjoy good food. And so one of the things that we did consciously was pick, you know, what we thought was the best catering operation that, you know, we could find. And the Metropolitan Police catering operation used to providing hot food in difficult circumstances for the biggest force in the country. And I thought they were probably the best bet. And so officers could go at any time and eat and enjoy the food. And I thought that was a good thing to maintain morale.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah, what was the first question?
First question was, how come, there's a few accountants questions coming in here. How come?
12,500, right, okay. Well, remember, there was lots of disorder elsewhere in Scotland, particularly in Edinburgh. So that 12,500 were at Gleneagles. I had quite a few thousand at Gleneagles. Because remember, you've got officers, you have to provide 24-hour security. And so you have to divide that into at least two shifts, say two 12-hour shifts, because you've got a day shift and a night shift. And then if you're splitting it between the venue and then other parts of Scotland, and there was quite a considerable amount of protest in Edinburgh in particular, I can assure you everybody was well employed.
And another accountant question from John Lisby. What was your budget?
Well, the budget turned out at the end of the day to be, before I give you the figure, when we started, it was very difficult around the budget. And the reason it was difficult was for this reason, that traditionally, this was like a national government's event, you know, so you, in most countries, the national government picks up the bill. The fact that it was in Scotland was a complication because the Scottish Executive, as it was then called, it wasn't called the Scottish Government, it was called the Scottish Executive, said, well, hang on a minute, what's our role in all this? You know, what part have we got to play? And it's untenable for us to actually, you know, stand up in the Scottish Parliament and say, well, it's nothing to do with us. And so there was, there had to be some sort of agreement between what is now the Scottish Government and the Westminster Government about roles and responsibilities and payments. And so it was unclear right at the beginning. I was spending money where the final amounts hadn't been actually agreed. And so at the end of the day, it cost 72 million. I think when all the figures had added up, it was a £72 million operation. I think that's the figure in the public domain if you wanted to Google it. So Not told you anything there that you can't find. But, that's the sort of figures that you're talking about for these events. They're the big events.
And did you have to keep the security hidden? Because one of the things I put in my, I think you told me that Tony Blair wanted it to look pretty casual, the whole thing. It wasn't like you surrounded the golf course with wiring and things.
Well, we did surround the golf course, but we surrounded it with called Harris fencing. It's the sort of thing you see at a building site, except we did it in a configuration which meant that it would buy us time. If people tried to get through, it would enable us to get resources to that spot if we needed to get resources to that. So, you know, you could probably climb over it if you had time, but we were working on the basis that, you know, we'd get someone there to stop you getting through because it would take you time to do it. I mean, there's part of the problem of having an event that's not in a populated area. So if you have an event like in the Rocky Mountains or on a golf course in the middle of Scotland, you've got no infrastructure there for anything. So you have to build it. You have to create it. You've got no natural barriers. You've got to create a catering operation. You've got to create and build a media centre for the world's media. You've got to find an armoury, you know, because there were armed officers there around the centre of the whole operation, not unnaturally. You've got to find accommodation. You've got to build briefing areas. And so it's a consequence of, you know, trying to situate somewhere, something like this in an area that's remote. And in that respect, it costs more than it perhaps would if you had buildings you could requisition in an urban environment and just, you know, use part of a city.
Brilliant. Question from golfer Alan McCulloch. What did the golfers, the members at Glen Eagles think about all this?
Well, not surprisingly, they weren't allowed to play. But actually, they actually were allowed to play for, I think a week before the event. I mean, you know, there were lots of people going up there to play golf, in and around all the arrangements, you know, being made for, I think, about a week before the actual security operation. We took the place over for about a week before the actual conference started. And we even had, it was quite amusing actually, because in some of the anarchist and anti-capitalist websites, you know, you could see pictures of the anti-capitalists playing golf at Glen Eagles, you know, and unfurling their banners, you know, while they're doing a spot of golfing. So, I mean, you know, it's a, I mean, you can't stop anybody going to a venue like that. You've got to obviously have a cutoff point where you secure it. But up until that point, you know, anybody could go up there and play golf.
And I think you told me it was 8 miles of fencing, 8 miles of fencing around the site.
Yeah, it was a considerable amount, because I mean, we couldn't really cut through this championship golf course. I mean, I think there must have been people having apoplexy, you know, at the prospect of us actually driving, you know, a fence and an internal roadway, you know, through the golf course. So we surrounded the whole golf course, in effect.
Okay, well, we're nearly running out of time, John. I'm just going to ask you one more question, then I'm going to turn the recording off, and perhaps you'll stay on and answer any questions.
Yeah, sure.
People. But so what was Tony Blair's reaction to this? I think you said you got the CBE for doing this, and I think you deserve it. Anyone deserves it. But
well, I mean, yeah, well, I mean, you know, the that's by the by, really. It's down to other people. But I mean, at the end of the day, Tony, I mean, Tony Blair was... went from, you know, when I first saw him, when he came to, well, it wasn't the first time I'd seen him. I'd seen him, obviously, prior to the event starting. But when he arrived from Singapore, he was absolutely elated. Of course, when he left the following day, he was, in despair, really, at what had happened in London, and was obviously going to deal with a very difficult situation as head of state, responding to an awful terrorist attack. He's a guy who I always think makes you feel as though you're the most important person in the room when he speaks to you. He's very good at the interpersonals, and he's very good at making, you know, looking you in the eye and making you feel as though he's listening to every word you're saying. So, you know, that was just my impression of Tony Blair.
Brilliant. Brilliant, John. Thank you. I've written down a lot of learning points from there. A lot of things are around preparation, aren't they? Preparation, yeah. Preparation, the security. Tim says that it's called redlining, red teaming, what you did, testing all the assumptions and getting people into a room. Probably been invented by somebody after you did it.
Yeah. And I think what's important is you need to write down, though. You know, it's important to write things down. So it's not just a matter of going through the motions. It's about writing, you know, writing up the notes and then doing something about it. And I don't think we're always good at doing that. And the other thing as well is, this is the sort of event where it's not a good idea to, you know, to just try and develop people who you think have got potential. It's important to get the best people you can possibly find, either within your command or to help you. So what I did as well is we had some really good people in our own force. It was a very good force. I would say that, wouldn't I? Because I was chief constable. But we had some very good people with good local relationships drawn from the local community. And we supported them with people with skills from other forces. You know, so forces which had, you know, middle ranking officers who were specialists in public order control, or were specialists in intelligence, or were specialists in search, we'd match them up with the people who had the local on the ground experience. We'd give them support by attaching to them people with specialist skills who could add skills to their experience. which they wouldn't ordinarily require, but they would require in this set of circumstances. And that really worked well.
It's the old adage, isn't it? Surround yourself with the best people, surround yourself with the right people. John, that was absolutely fantastic. And I'll ask everybody to, I'm going to put it on gallery view to give you a round of applause in the usual live chat show.
Thank you.
So if you'd stay on, John, that would be fabulous. And also, if you'd agree to come back on in January and February. If
you've already got this on tape. You don't need to ask me again.
Sometimes I close a sale twice, John, although I've been advised you only close it once.
Yeah.
You don't come back. So if you're watching this on YouTube or the podcast or listening to this on the podcast, please don't forget to book for the 7th of December, which is a totally free public event for any of our friends, where I've got four plus me of the best experts in the world. And thank you for joining. Thank you very much indeed, John, once again.
Pleasure.